Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, WRNI Providence, this is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. Big Tobacco has another dirty secret. This time, it's not nicotine, but cigarette smuggling. According to the World Health Organization, smuggling accounts for 25% of U.S. cigarette exports. A report in today's Los Angeles Times says U.S. officials are investigating allegations that tobacco firms are sending huge shipments to Iraq despite the embargo. More and more Americans are kicking the habit, but more and more people abroad are taking it up. Now that smoking has gone abroad and ceased, at least in its old way, to be a national problem, is it something we should worry about? What do we owe the world? Are you willing to take away the livelihood of tobacco farmers to take down big tobacco? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from New York is Mark Shapiro, an investigative reporter who wrote about cigarette smuggling for The Nation. Welcome, Mark Shapiro.
Good evening.
Good evening to you. With me in the studio is tonight's news analyst, Judith Kiam, executive director of the Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and formerly an attorney with the U.S. Justice Department. Welcome.
Good
nice
evening,
to have
Jack.
You. excuse me. Mark Shapiro,
yes.
Tell us your tale. You spent 6 months investigating cigarette smuggling in Colombia. What did you find out?
Well, what I found out was that, in fact, the tobacco companies have, in a desire to enter into international markets, and like you've said, there have been a decline in smoking in the United States, so foreign markets have become much more important to the cigarette companies. Part of their strategy involved smuggling the cigarettes into foreign countries. I look specifically at the situation in Colombia and spent a lot of time in a northern province of Colombia called La Guajira, which is a smuggling center in Colombia. Spoke with a number of people who were involved in smuggling the cigarettes themselves and also analyzed a great deal of internal corporate documents.
Internal corporate documents to what corporations?
This is from Philip Morris Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And also the Brown and Williamson, which is owned by British American Tobacco.
Okay. So you looked at the evidence in Colombia, and you looked at some of these documents, and what does it reveal?
What it reveals is that over a period of at least a decade, those tobacco companies were involved in marketing, in pricing, in establishing distribution systems for getting their cigarettes into Colombia without paying the taxes that are required at the border and without even registering them in any way. And this was done through a means of cigarettes would leave the ports in the United States, would go through a transit center in Aruba. In Aruba, they'd be broken down into smaller packages and sent into a port in northern Colombia, where they would then be smuggled into the interior of Colombia. And in Colombia, you would find, and I've spent a great deal of time working in Colombia, U.S. cigarettes, Marlboro, Newport Cool, quite abundant on the streets of Bogota, Medellin, Cali, all over the country.
And because they are smuggled, are their prices then lower than that would be if they were sent there legitimately?
Prices far lower. If you were to pay the proper taxes that are charged by the Colombian government, you'd be paying about $4 or $5 for a pack of cigarettes. That, of course, would make it impossible to compete in a country like Colombia. Instead, you'd walk down the street in Colombia, you could buy a pack of Marlboro for a buck and a quarter, which is just a tiny bit above what the national brand there would be selling for. So they were going essentially head-to-head with the national brands. And one of the results of this situation has been the increasing dominance of Philip Morris and BAT in Colombia and the decline of the Colombian tobacco industry. One side effect of that has been that many thousands of tobacco farmers in Colombia were no longer able to make a living growing tobacco, so they shifted to, of course, Colombia's other well-known export product, coca leaf.
I see. So in other words, it's partly it's displaced tobacco farmers on account of our surreptitious, our smuggled imports, cigarette imports, who are turning to cocoa farming.
Exactly.
So our export of death to them is sort of crossing with their export of death to us, you might say.
Of drugs to us, sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, this reached a legal crux down there. What was, tell us about that.
The legal situation is this, that the Colombian government found that as a result of this, hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes and import duties were not being paid. And to make it clear, those taxes in Colombia go to primarily to the states of Colombia, and they go to finance primarily health and education programs. So they found that hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes were not being paid, and the Colombian government decided to sue the U.S. tobacco companies, and they lodged a lawsuit in the year 2000. 22 of Colombia's states, along with the capital city of Bogota, sued Philip Morris and Brown and Williamson, British American Tobacco, alleging a long-time smuggling operation and alleging that a great deal of the money that was used to purchase the smuggled cigarettes came from drug sales in the United States.
And what's the status of that suit?
That suit has gone through many, many developments here in the U.S. legal system. The situation right now is that the tobacco companies have long been arguing that the U.S. courts do not have jurisdiction over matters involving the collection of foreign taxes. Mm-hmm. They rely on an 18th century precedent, which is known as the Revenue Rule, which prohibits foreign governments from trying to obtain tax revenues from U.S. corporations. Going back to that essentially 300-year-old rule, in February, a U.S. Federal court judge stated, dismissed the lawsuit on the grounds that the Colombian states had no legal right to hear the case in a U.S. court. Now, I would add also that the same exact, the same suit alleging very similar process has also been filed by 10 European nations. Mm-hmm. We're talking about France, Germany, Italy, Spain, mm-hmm. some of our closest allies, have filed a very similar lawsuit.
About smuggling in their country.
About smuggling into their country, saying mm-hmm. that they've lost hundreds of millions of dollars in tax revenue. Mm-hmm. Both suits were, dropped by the district court judge. On the ground that the court has no right to hear such cases involving foreign taxes. Mm-hmm. That case is now being appealed mm-hmm. to the U.S. Appeals Court here in New York. Mm-hmm. And the Europeans and the Colombians are refiling a separate suit on separate money laundering grounds, alleging that the
money laundering grounds.
Yes,
now, that brings us to the Patriot Act.
Right.
Judy Kayyem.
Right. Oh, no, I mean, Mark mentions in his article, and it's definitely true that, you know, as everything now seems to relate to counterterrorism and terrorism, so has this debate. During the debates regarding the USA Patriot Act, smartly, some congressmen put in language that would have made it, for financial anti-terrorist purposes, a crime, or expanded the definition of money laundering to include the very activity that we're hearing about the cigarette companies are doing. In other words, if you attempt to defraud a foreign government or a foreign government entity, that seems smart. From, of course, the terrorism perspective, because money and how money transfers hands is very important for tracking terrorists. But, of course, the cigarette lobby getting very concerned because, as you mentioned before, Mark, the cigarette lobby was concerned that this, if this part of the Patriot Act gets into law, it's going to give standing to the very countries that want to sue the cigarette companies in U.S. courts. It's going to permit Canada, the European countries, and Colombia and all its entities. It's going to let them be there. And they're going to say, look, these companies, these big companies, are defrauding us. They are undermining our authority to tax and regulate. They're doing all sorts of bad things vis-a-vis cigarettes. And so very smartly, as they tend to be, the cigarette lobby lobbied, in particular, a Republican representative from Ohio, Michael Oakley, and got that piece of legislation out of the USA Patriot Act. From the perspective of fighting terrorism, that is bad news, because it's, you know, it would have been good legislation to have in there to go after entities, whether they're tobacco companies or whoever else, who are defrauding government. So basically what the, you know, to be quite honest, what the cigarette companies wanted, they got. And sort of at the disservice, I think, of sort of protection of the U.S. government and U.S. people.
Yeah, Mark Shapiro, you're right. You asked the question, is smuggling then a patriotic act? We're almost forced
to. Well, that's a good question. I mean, Juliet, first of all, explained that extremely clearly. And what's particularly outrageous about this is if you go back to October of this time, this occurred in October, essentially 3 weeks after the terrorist attack, the whole country was absorbed in what are we going to do about this horrible thing that happened. And like Juliet said, the Justice Department introduced this means which would tighten regulation of financial transactions that could finance terrorism. In the midst of all this, and let's remember the anthrax attack had happened in the House and in the Senate, and offices were being evacuated. And literally during that chaotic time, this measure that would have subjected the U.S. court, that essentially would have trumped the revenue rule, which I just explained, was taken out by Michael Oakley with the support of the White House.
With the support of the White House.
Yes. Yeah.
So cigarettes trump terrorism.
Exactly.
I hope so sometimes. I mean, what is, you know, Mark, your story is in some ways not new, right? That, you know, sort of the typical view of the tobacco company as being big and ruthless and mean. What is new about your story is the incredible risks that these companies are willing to take to create or expand into new markets. I mean, if it's true that regulation in the United States and all sorts of, you know, and public education and stopping kids from smoking have assisted in decreasing the amount of revenue the cigarette companies are getting here, they are willing to go to tremendous risk to get new markets abroad. And what I mean when I say tremendous risk is we're no longer talking about civil penalties anymore. We're
right.
talking about crime, and people will go to jail for this if caught. I mean, that clearly raises the ante for the cigarette companies in ways that, you know, financial slapping on the hand saying you owe us a couple $100,000, which, you know, is nothing to a cigarette company. You know, the risks that they're willing to take, including going to jail, that's the new story in some ways.
Excuse me, Jay.
Go ahead, Mark.
I think what's critical about that point is exactly correct, is that now we have a situation in the U.S. legal system which has set up obstacles for foreign governments to essentially hold U.S. corporations,
right.
in this case the tobacco companies, accountable for alleged wrongdoing in foreign nations. So here we are at a time of incredible globalization, of the intertwining of international economies, of the increasing export orientation of American companies, and the desire of the administration to take down trade barriers, et cetera. And yet the ability of foreign governments to say, wait a minute, you're breaking our laws here, we've got a problem here, is severely constrained by the existing legal system.
I should point out, Philip Morris gives a statement. It says it does not condone, facilitate, or support the smuggling of cigarettes and cooperates with governments in their efforts to prevent illegal trade in the products we manufacture. They say the biggest problem with respect to smuggled cigarettes involves counterfeit products, which cause damage to both Philip Morris and the Colombian government. What about the counterfeit products idea?
This is something that I don't want to discount that as a problem. It is a problem. If you travel anywhere in the world, you're going to see knockoff jeans, knockoff watches, knockoff cigarettes, and
knockoff Marlboros here.
Sorry?
These would be like knockoff Marlboros.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And those do exist, and they do strike at the trademark rights of cigarette companies, and those rights should be defended on the trademark grounds. But the fact is that for many years, the tobacco companies did knowingly engage in this kind of smuggling activity. In the last year or two, really since the lawsuits were filed, there has been some reform by the cigarette companies. In Colombia, they began to come to an agreement with the customs to begin to reduce the level of cigarettes smuggled. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that is there has been a reduction of cigarette smuggling into Colombia as a result of this agreement. Many people in Colombia say, well, that's good. But many of the government officials say, well, wait a minute, if they could turn it off so quickly, they were the, you know, they controlled the tap.
Mark, we'll get right back to you. We're talking about the internationalization of cigarettes via smuggling this hour. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Stoke up your outrage. We're at this. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the internationalization of the cigarette market via smuggling and also its legal proliferation in the world. And we're asking, really asking, what do we owe the world? And are you willing to take away the livelihood of tobacco farmers to take down big tobacco? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We should say before we proceed that we tried to get a spokesperson from one of the cigarette companies to join us, and they wouldn't, and they sent us instead a statement in which they disavowed, Philip Morris did, any connection with smuggling. Our guests, Mark Shapiro, who's an associate at the Center for Investigative Reporting and has written a mind-opening investigative piece about cigarette smuggling in Colombia in The Nation, and our news analyst, Judith Kayyem. And with us now is Kenneth Warner, professor of public health and director of the Tobacco Research Network. Welcome, Kenneth Warner.
Thank you.
Now, Kenneth Warner, you are one of the world-class experts on the entire economics of cigarette smoking and its health effects. And you've written a piece in the a sort of distillation of your work in the current Foreign Policy magazine, in which you sort of enumerate some of the myths and other notions about cigarettes. And one of the myths you are one of the sort of shibboleths you take on is the claim, quote, higher cigarette taxes encourage smuggling. Presumably, that's an argument made by cigarette companies. Is that a true statement?
Well, it's true in part. I mean, taxes and price differentials, what we're talking about here, are certainly a factor in smuggling, but they're only one of many factors. And there have been studies, particularly in Europe, that demonstrate that they're frankly not as important as a country's general approach to the issue of corruption and its specific concerns with policing smuggling itself. There's a wonderful example of this.
Mm-hmm.
Spain, which had one of the lowest cigarette prices in all of Europe, had one of the highest smuggling problems. Something on the order of 30% of their cigarettes were smuggled, even though they had one of the lowest prices in Europe. They decided to get serious about smuggling, and the rate of smuggling of cigarettes in Spain is down to about 3% now.
And, you know, I could add to that. It's interesting, Dr. Warner. In Colombia, I spoke with many government officials in Colombia, and they spoke about how they had been lobbied strenuously by the tobacco companies to lower their cigarette taxes. And in fact, they did lower the cigarette taxes dramatically, more than 50%, and had no impact whatsoever on smuggling. And in fact, you had on the one hand the tobacco companies officially lobbying to lower taxes, and on the other hand being involved in the very smuggling networks that were bringing the cigarettes in.
Yeah, if I could add to that,
sure.
There are two forms of smuggling. One of them is the concern that the industry, of course, plays on, and this is the notion that people are going to cross adjacent borders, they're going to buy cigarettes in low-tax and hence low-price regions and take them into high-tax regions next door. It may be states, it may be countries or what have you. We refer to that in the trade as butt-legging.
Butt-legging.
Butt-legging. That actually constitutes a very small proportion of total smuggling. The problem in its major form is, as Mr. Shapiro has described it in his absolutely magnificent and eye-opening article, it is, in fact, organized crime, and the price differences are a relatively small part of the story here.
Another argument, of course, that tobacco makers, manufacturers bring up is the claim that declining profits in America have driven them into developing countries, both licitly and illicitly. What's your take on that claim?
Well, that's actually one of the favorite arguments of the tobacco control community. They say that we are forcing the tobacco companies into these poor countries because we're doing so well in controlling tobacco consumption in our countries. In point of fact, we're not talking about a balloon of fixed size so that if you squeeze the profits on one end, they've got to pop out somewhere else. There's no limit on the profits that the industry can make, and they're going into these other countries for three reasons. One is they've got just oodles of money sitting in their treasuries, and they've got to figure out ways to spend it productively so it will earn more money. Second, the general easing of trade barriers has certainly worked for all international commerce, and that includes cigarettes. And then finally, we're beginning to observe the emergence of a level of consumer income in many of these targeted countries that's adequate to support the consumption of Western cigarettes. So, frankly, they would have been going into these countries under any circumstances. We need to keep something in mind. Cigarette consumption is declining in the U.S. It's been declining about 2% a year for many, many years now. But profits have been rising.
Profits are rising even though sales are down.
Correct. Because the cigarette companies have been raising their wholesale prices. And although that does induce a decline in consumption, the proportionate increase in their revenues is far greater than the decline in consumption.
And you mentioned that they're sitting on oodles of money. One had the impression that these suits on the part of the states and others had you know, emptied the treasuries, or at least taxed the treasuries of these companies. Is that just a false impression?
It is. I mean, this is a popular notion. But just to put this into perspective, the state lawsuits, the attorneys general lawsuits, cumulatively across all 50 states are resulting in payments of about $240 billion over a 25-year period. Now, to you and me, that begins to sound like real money. To the cigarette companies, they jacked their prices up by 40, 45 cents, and they've solved their problem.
Let's take a call. Pat is on the line. By the way, we're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Pat, welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for taking me.
Well, thank you for calling.
I had a question. You sort of answered it with the whole butt-licking notion, but I wanted to follow it up. I live in Massachusetts, and right now, because of the financial crisis, there's a talk of raising an awful lot of taxes, including the cigarette tax, to the point where something like 38% of what someone would pay for a pack of cigarettes, they're paying to either the state or federal government. And the argument against this that has been made when I was living in New York and now I'm living in Massachusetts on some fronts is that you create this black market for cigarettes where, you know, people won't go to the convenience stores, they'll go someplace else where they don't have to pay all these taxes. And does anything that you've seen in your reporting or in your investigating bear one way or the other on that?
Kenneth Warner?
There's no question but that if there are substantial price differences with large population centers close to a state border, that that can cause some of what we refer to as butt-legging or informal smuggling. However, in no state at any point in time has a tax increase, even if it was already a high tax state, has it produced a reduction in revenues. It always increases revenues, and in fact, the amount is quite predictable. If you look at large population concentrations very close to a very low tax border, for example, Boston and New Hampshire, you will see some informal smuggling. But, I mean, there's no opportunity greater than that one, the New Hampshire and Massachusetts story. And Massachusetts is not losing lots and lots of revenues to smuggling.
I read out the WHO also estimates, just from a health perspective, that taxation, of course, has been a very important means of controlling the health impacts of cigarette smoking. And the WHO estimates that if you were to increase the price of a pack of cigarettes about 10%, you would save the lives of around 40 million people if this was done around the world.
10%.
Sorry?
Mark, is that because, I mean, is that theory because the idea that then people, a certain cadre of people, let's assume poorer people who really don't have great access to health care throughout the world will actually stop smoking?
Right. Yeah. There's been a number of studies that seem to indicate that the higher the price of cigarettes goes, the less people smoke.
Mm. Jack, can I chime in on that one?
Yeah, I don't know. You probably have a comment on that.
Ken Warner, but yes, Mark, we want to say goodbye to you. We know you have to get on. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Mark Shapiro, he's an associate at the Center for Investigative Reporting and the author of a long and important article in The Nation on cigarette smuggling in Colombia. Kenneth Warner, excuse me, I interrupted you.
No, it's quite right. I was just going to say that increasing prices not only discourages people who are already smoking from continuing to smoke, mm-hmm. but it seems to be particularly effective in discouraging kids from getting addicted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They are more price responsive for a whole variety of reasons than adults who've been smoking for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But just to put this figure, the 40 million lives that would be saved, into perspective, WHO currently estimates that about 500 million people alive today will be killed by tobacco.
Yeah.
There are about 1.2 billion cigarette smokers on the planet at the present time. So 40 million lives saved. There's probably nothing else that we could do in the realm of health or health care mm-hmm. that would compare with that, but it would still represent only a dent in the nature of the international health crisis that we have looming before us.
Mm. Jonathan is on the line. Welcome.
Hi.
I
wanted to say that maybe these prices should go up, because I find it that the secondhand smoke that so many people are inhaling, kids, pregnant people, it's almost as if they're invading your privacy. You go outside in public and you're breathing it in. It's toxic.
Mm.
And I think that the prices definitely should go up. And also, you mentioned earlier that these big tobacco companies are sitting on all this money. And it's really, I find it like it's dirty money. It's impure money. They're getting this money from killing people. And I think that there should definitely be stricter rules in enforcing where cigarettes can be smoked and near schools and all that.
Yeah, that's a real revolution just in your lifetime, Jonathan, because this is really new, this stuff. You know, when I was growing up, people were blowing smoke in your face all the time.
Right. I remember a time, and I'm not that old, but I remember a time when the smoking section on airplanes used to be the other side of the aisle. I mean,
right.
You know, the right side would not smoke and the left side would. And we have, I mean, in terms of public education, it's been a remarkable change about how we feel about smoking and, of course, how we feel about the tobacco industry.
And how far we've gone, even in just medical opinion. A friend of mine who is one of eight children said that when his mother had the last baby in about 1950, the doctor looked at her and said, "Peg, why don't you switch to menthols now?" we've come some distance from there. Ken Warner, though, Jonathan raises a really interesting question here, and that is about the conscience, not just of the executives of these cigarette companies, but the stockholders. My question to you is, what do we know about the conscience of the people who work for cigarette companies? Do they sincerely believe that they're representing a product that's respectable? And second, what about pressure from stockholders? Why aren't people voting with their convictions and essentially defunding these companies at the source?
Well, first of all, I am not an ethicist, and neither am I a psychiatrist, so I can't look inside their heads. It certainly would be my impression that there's got to be a lot of cognitive dissonance going on in these folks, because they have to understand the seriousness of the effects of the products they're producing. But frankly, my suspicion is that the industry has done a very good job with its own employees as it has with the public.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the really striking features of the debate about tobacco, and I give the industry full credit for its brilliance in having convinced the public of this, is that the public in general views tobacco as, yes, a cause of disease, but they see it as just one more factor in this environmental stew of things to which we're
mm-hmm.
exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's a unique factor, and it's uniquely important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as for the stockholders, there have been initiatives, every stockholder meeting for years now to do something to reduce the toll of the products, and they've all been defeated by the stockholders who I suspect they're just more concerned with their returns. I should note there are many organizations, including, I'm pleased to say, my own university, that have divested themselves of tobacco stocks.
That's not easy to do, is it? Because these tobacco companies are parts of large combines that make other kinds of food products.
Oh, absolutely. Years ago, I remember Dr. Koop, when he was Surgeon General, saying that the cigarette companies make everything that you and I don't.
I wanted to touch base or continue to talk about the smuggling issue also, because it seems to me that even if we get a reform going on stopping the smuggling, that as Mark points out in his article, is enhanced or, you know, promoted by the tobacco companies, how they really are going to benefit in the long term from their illegal action, you know, today. So even if reforms are made and smuggling is stopped, in some of these countries, right, the massive amounts of advertising for, you know, smoking Marlboro Lights or smoking a certain kind of American cigarette go very far. If you're in a third world country, you're viewed as Western, maybe modernized, you know, and Britney Spears is caught walking with the cigarette in her hand, and smoking is in some ways very sexy. And so even if the industry got out of the smuggling business, they've created, both through advertising and by getting people to pick up cigarettes, a long-term market that wouldn't have otherwise existed.
Mm. Ken, is that square with your sense of it?
Oh, it's absolutely.
They're seeding the market illegally, and then if they stop, they say, well, okay, we stop, but they've seeded the market.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question about that. And, you know, frankly, they would love it if the markets could continue to go on as they have. I should note that the U.S. announced at something called the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which is the World Health Organization's attempt to get an international treaty on tobacco control. Mm-hmm. The U.S. delegation announced that it was going to spearhead an effort to have an international meeting in New York this summer, precisely to deal with this issue of smuggling, how we go about trying to put a stop to it and trying to get some controls on it. I hope that they follow through with that.
Mm-hmm. In your article, Ken Warner, in Foreign Policy, you go through a number of these sort of shibboleths about cigarette smoking, and one of them is that advertising encourages children to smoke, and you say, well, we don't know.
We don't have any absolutely definitive evidence on that. I certainly believe that it does. Mm-hmm. And if I look at the cumulative weight of the evidence, I would judge that it does influence smoking by children. But we don't have the proverbial smoking gun here. And frankly, I don't think it's possible to design the experiment that would be required to come up with the precise answer. The best study that I have seen concludes that if we could ban all forms of advertising and promotion, this doesn't mean just the ad you see in magazines or billboards, but if you get rid of everything, that you could reduce smoking by about 7%. Now, that would be a tremendous public health victory, but it obviously, again, would be the tip of the iceberg here. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of influences that we don't have control over that are probably more important.
Among them, as you were mentioning, Judith, people like celebrities seen smoking, and people smoking in the movies has immense influence, doesn't it? That kind of thing. I mean, Humphrey Bogart made the cigarette a prop of manhood. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
Boston.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the international cigarette market this hour, and we're sort of asking the question, what does it mean to be the world's leading exporter of cancer? And is this something that we want our government to subsidize, as it now does in part at the bottom end with growers and throughout the process through AIDS to exporters? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest is Kenneth Warner, professor of public health and director of the Tobacco Research Institute. Kenneth Walker, again, in your foreign policy argument article, another shibboleth you tackle is cigarette tax increases burden the poor. I've heard this again and again, that we can't here, people can't in foreign governments, raise taxes on cigarettes without disproportionately hurting people who can afford at least.
But this, of course, is a very common argument, and it's said with genuine crocodile tears by the industry, which itself, by the way, raises its own prices so that it can increase its profits, and doesn't seem to have the same concerns when it does that. It is true that cigarette taxes are regressive. That means that poor people who tend to, they're more likely to smoke than rich people, they will pay a higher proportion of their income in cigarette tax. What is not necessarily true is that a tax increase is regressive. The reason being that rich people who smoke do not tend to have their smoking behavior affected very much by a price increase.
Mm.
Poor people are much more price responsive.
Mm.
So what we see when we have a price increase and a tax increase is that the people who are most burdened by smoking, most addicted to it, the poor, who have disproportionate amounts of smoking-related disease, they are the group that will be more likely to respond by quitting or not starting to smoke in the first place. And, of course, that means a progressive health benefit.
Mm. Now, I mentioned hyperbolically that the federal government supports the tobacco industry. Can you count the ways for us?
Well, there's a complicated, very antiquated system of price supports and tobacco, I guess you'd call them like the taxicab medallion, the liquor license. Mm-hmm. You have to hold an allotment in order to grow tobacco in this country. You're not allowed just to grow tobacco unless you have one of these, and you got these during the Great Depression. That's mm-hmm. when they were handed out.
Mm-hmm.
The so-called subsidy in the U.S. is actually a very small part of this arcane system I'm describing.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the net impact of the system itself, ironically, is to raise cigarette prices a tiny bit, perhaps 2 or 3 cents per pack, if that, maybe 1 cent a pack.
Mm-hmm.
That in and of itself would probably discourage cigarette consumption a little bit, a tiny bit, simply because it's a price increase. But the principal impact of the system has been to persuade Congress to keep its hands off of tobacco.
Yes.
And the White House.
Mm-hmm.
President Clinton was the very first president who was ever willing to tackle the issue of tobacco.
Mm. And what did he do?
Well, he saw this as a politically smart move to try to produce some opposition to tobacco in Congress and to try to come up with policies that would do something about the tobacco problem in the country. Specifically, the Food and Drug Administration, with his support, developed a policy that was dramatic to the extent that it actually was attempting to address the issue, but was very mild in terms of the steps that it took. It
mm-hmm.
banned smoking within so many feet of It banned billboards within so many feet of schools.
Mm-hmm.
It required people selling cigarettes to check birth dates on anyone who looked to be 27 or
mm-hmm.
younger,
mm-hmm.
and a few other things like that.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Betsy. Hello. Betsy?
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
Well,
go right ahead.
Well, I'd like to suggest that maybe, you know, the U.S. government should not be in the business of, you know, continuing to provide this arcane system of allotments and maybe discourage people from growing tobacco and possibly also, you know, not providing subsidies to the manufacturers of cigarettes for that tobacco.
Well, you raised the question there, and that's a question you take up, Kenneth Warner, when you talk about this issue of our anti-smoking policies hazardous to our economic health. Can we afford to do this? Isn't this burdensome for farmers, and wouldn't it be a disaster for North Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee, and so on?
Well, the short answer to that is absolutely not. It's an issue that the tobacco industry raises whenever any tobacco control policy is under consideration in a state legislature. They say, look at all the sales that are associated with cigarettes. Look at the jobs. And frankly, they raise the issue not so much in North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
where people are sensitive to the issue, but in states like yours or mm-hmm. mine, mm-hmm. where the principal people benefiting from the sale of cigarettes are retail clerks. And they're also wholesale folks. But there's a simple fact of life here, and let's put some perspective on this. I mean, actually, those of you in Massachusetts that used to have a shoe industry and mm-hmm. a textile mm-hmm. industry right. in New England, that went down the tubes pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. We're talking about an addictive substance here for which, in the face of pretty substantial anti-smoking activity, has seen declines of 2% per year for the period now of a couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
What does that translate into? It means, in effect, that farmers aren't going to lose their jobs because of the anti-smoking
right.
movement.
They'll find other jobs.
Well, it's not even that. They're mm-hmm. not going to lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. It's going to be normal attrition.
Mm.
The farmers who die, the farmers who retire, will not be replaced at the same rate.
Kenneth Warner, thank you. Kenneth Warner is professor of public health and director of the Tobacco Research Network. Judah Kayyem, thank you. Listeners,
thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, finding contemporary resonance in avant-garde pop music from the Vietnam era. This is On Point. Periodically, we turn to music experts and to listeners to share with us the music they're turning to at this particular moment in history. We call it Music and the Moment. Tonight, we hear from Theodore Gracek. He teaches philosophy at the University of Minnesota's Moorhead campus and is the author of two academic books about popular music. He's found that two songs from two of the more experimental rock and roll artists of the Vietnam era speak well to our contemporary moment.
5 Years is the opening track on the Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars albums of 1972, about aliens taking over the Earth and informing the Earth that our time is limited. In 5 years, the Earth will end. But this leads you into the album, and it leads you in an interesting way. It builds very slowly. It starts very matter-of-factly, almost journalistically.
Pushing through the market square, so many mothers sighing. News had just come over. We had 5 years left crying.
He describes what he sees. What he builds to with a very close attention to detail in the lyrics, and the music builds behind him as he does this, is he just looks at one thing after another, and gradually you get a picture in a time of chaos.
I never thought I'd need so many people.
You get a picture of people coming together in surprising ways. One of the most interesting images is a cop knelt and kissed the feet of a priest, and a queer threw up at the sight of that.
A cop knelt and kissed the feet of a priest, and the queer threw up at the sight of that.
The lines being drawn between people at the same time that they're coming together in a public way. And this leads to the next verse, in which he starts thinking about people that he hasn't seen, that he wants to be connected to. I think I saw you in an ice cream parlor. He's trying to decide, did I see you? Are you gone? Am I not going to see you again? And that's the section that really resonates, I think, recently, as people in our culture feel very in need of making connection to people with one another again.
We got 5 years, stop going.
The thing about the song that resonates is that as it builds, particularly to the climax where he trades the vocal lines with the band back and forth, is this building notion of surprise, the dislocation of modern life. And I think a lot of people, I'm in a state right now that We're very dislocated. Minnesota is in a severe recession. Everybody I know is anxious, dislocated. How could this happen here is something that I often hear from people. And this is a song that's really about that emotion. Century Schizoid Man is a song I had not played for years because, in part, my wife found it annoying. And it really is an annoying piece of music. It's not inviting. It's not warm. It doesn't make you feel good. What it is that it's an assault on the senses. It's an assault on your sensibility. And particularly for somebody of a rock music generation, it's a very unorthodox song. The large sections of it are in 6/8 time. We're not used to that. We're used to 4/4 time. It goes from brutally fast syncopated music to moments of unexpected silence. To a very free jazz solo in the dead center. This is very unsettling music, even the voice. It's the one song by King Crimson where the voice has been electronically altered. Greg Lake of Emerson, Lake & Palmer has a wonderful singing voice, but here it's distorted and ugly to reinforce a sense of dislocation. 21st century schizoid man. So anyway, it's not an inviting song, and even though I like King Crimson, I don't play them a lot. I don't play this song in particular a lot for many years because it's just very unpleasant, and raising small children and so on, it wasn't the kind of thing to play. But it was something that I came back to last fall, because it really is a song, once you get over, say, the shock of September 11 and the dislocation people are experiencing, it's a song about the anxiety of modern life, and that's directly what it addresses. It explicitly talks about paranoia at our door. It uses images which, of its time, 1969, the middle verse images of blood-racked barbed wire, napalm fire, are very much images Americans were familiar with, and, of course, Europe through the nightly news images of the Vietnam War. I was a preteen at the time and remember all those images very vividly. And this song focuses on them, except it very prophetically projects them into the next century. It says in 1969, we're going to be living with this for a long time. And I think for many years we've been complacent because we haven't thought about these images relating to ourselves in any way. And yet here they are again in our lives in many ways, and here's a song that addresses that.
Theodore Grasek lives in Moorhead, Minnesota. He's the author of the new book, I Wanna Be Me, Rock Music and the Politics of Identity. Listeners, we want to hear from you. What music are you turning to these days? What songs or symphonies, artists or albums are resonating with you now? Send us an email at onpoint@wbur.org and tell us about it. We may be hearing your voice on a future program. I'm Jack Beattie. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're fun.